Yeah, so I just wanted to say a couple of things about some work that wasn't really anything to do with interference or higher order interference, but which I think maybe can tell us something useful about some of this stuff. The first thing I'd like to talk a little bit about is a contextuality experiment that was done in collaboration with Mike Mazurek, Ravi Kunjwal, Kevin Resch, and Rob. And you can... read all about it. The sort of issue I think that this kind of thinking might help us address is basically all of the definitions of higher order interference that we've heard discussed so far use some kind of idealization that in quantum theory corresponds to projective measurements. Okay, so we heard in Howard's talk about these projections that are, you know, when you do them twice, that's exactly the same as doing them once. And there are these faces of states where with probability one, you get that outcome. And there were kind of similar ideas being used in John's talk. And obviously, if we're going to do an experiment, we're not going to have these kinds of things available to us. And there's basically just a very similar problem when you're trying to do an experimental test of contextuality in that a lot of the definitions and proofs of contextuality rely on projective measurements. And, you know, they're just as unavailable in those experiments as they would be in an interference experiment. So I just wanted to say a little bit about how we addressed these kinds of issues in this experiment. And the first thing I want to say is really just a very kind of general, probably fairly obvious methodological point, which is that the kind of starting point for contextuality is a definition by Cation and Speckle. And if you don't know anything about this definition, don't worry, it's not going to be too relevant. But an important part of this definition is that if you do a projective measurement, then you represent this deterministically. Okay, so hope I've spelled that right. You know, this is a theorem about hidden variable models, and there's this assumption that when you do a projective measurement, that corresponds to a deterministic outcome in this hidden variable model. Okay, so you know, this is.
You say it's a deterministic outcome for a given initial state, or is it a different?
So if you know the value of the hidden variables and you're doing a projective measurement, then you can predict the outcome of that measurement with certainty.
Okay, so it's, okay, or hidden variable, yeah, okay.
So this is kind of precisely this problem of, well, if you don't actually have access to projective measurements, what are you gonna do here? And there's basically two routes that you might imagine taking to fixing this problem. The first one is, you might try and sort of define some kind of notion of being close to a projective measurement, okay? I mean, ideally you would do this in a way that doesn't make reference to quantum theory, but you know, you would have some kind of definition that says that I'm somehow epsilon close to a projective measurement. Okay? And then you could just sort of say, well, I'm just going to extrapolate this assumption and say, you know, not just that projective measurements have to be represented deterministically, but that measurements that are in some, you know, defined sense, epsilon close to projective, are going to be sort of epsilon close to deterministic. So this, if you did something like this, then on a technical level, it would solve the problem. You know, presumably in your experiment, you would be able to characterize how close you've got to doing a projective measurement, and then you'd be able to see whether your statistics are compatible with being this close to deterministic in your hidden variable theory. But on a conceptual level, it would be pretty unsatisfying because someone else could come along and say, well, I have this different way of quantifying how close you are to doing a projective measurement, or I have this different way of quantifying how close your model is to being deterministic. And I think those are the things you should use in this assumption, right? So there's really no, on the face of it, there's no unique way of going from this idealized assumption to some more practical assumption. Like, you know, precisely because this only talks about the perfect case, there's kind of an ambiguity about how you're going to extend that to the imperfect cases. And I think if you just kind of try to take some of these definitions of higher order inference and just start kind of directly throwing around epsilons, you might face this similar problem of realizing it's kind of a bit arbitrary how you do that. But luckily, at least in the case of contextuality, it turns out there's a different approach, which is to sort of try and understand what the principles are behind these kinds of assumptions, state those principles very generically. And this is something that Rob did. So there's a sort of Speckens definition of contextuality. And again, it doesn't matter too much if you don't know what that is. But the important thing about it is that it doesn't make any direct reference to projective measurements. Okay, so it just talks about very general sort of operational procedures and makes certain assumptions about how they're represented. And then the sort of thing that was realized quite recently and that went into this experiment is that from this more general notion, you can actually derive a statement of this form. Okay, so I think this is the sort of high road to going from these idealized statements to these sort of more robust, experimentally relevant statements. Is don't just kind of take your assumption and throw some epsilons in. Think more carefully about, you know, what justifies your assumption, and what more general notion you might want to define, and then hopefully you can just derive this, and that makes it a lot less arbitrary, right? Because now you haven't just chosen what these measures are; these actually come from some kind of principle. And so I think that might be what we need to do in the case of inference. You know, we have these definitions at the moment that are in these kind of idealized terms, and maybe we need to identify what principle is really at stake in these kinds of inference experiments, state that more generally, and then derive what the consequences would be under more realistic conditions. You know, and hopefully, just as this definition reduces to the Cochin-Speckier definition under the right idealizations, hopefully this definition of this sort of general principle of defining inference would also reduce to the definitions we've heard about in those cases. Okay, so that was the kind of vague rant. And then the other thing I just wanted to say is just to tell you a little bit about what the definition of being close to projective is that you get by taking this route. Just because it's possible that if you go the same route with inference, you might end up in a similar place. So it's, you know, this is kind of a sneak preview of where you might end up if you do that. Okay. So, well, before saying what the definition of being epsilon close turns out to be, it's useful just to state in terms that don't involve quantum theory just what projective means, or the kind of projectiveness that you need in order to do this argument. And that's pretty simple. Basically, so I'll try and use the same sort of notation as John did yesterday. So we have a bunch of effects like this, and we want to know whether these, in some sense, correspond to a projective measurement. And the first thing you have to check is, does there exist a set of states such that when I prepare those states, I get those outcomes with certainty. Okay? And it's maybe, so this is kind of the definition in generalized probabilistic theories, but it's useful just to see what that would correspond to in quantum theory, just to kind of get an intuition for what's going on. And so in quantum theory, what this would mean is that the effect EI has to be greater than or equal to the projector onto the support of rho I. Okay? So just to take a simple example, so rho I is the density matrix corresponding to this state I, and EI is the PAVM effect corresponding to this measurement outcome. So just to take a simple example, if this was rho zero and this was rho one, then something like this would tell you that you might have a PAVM like this, okay? And this would explain why when you prepare the state, you definitely get this outcome, and why when you prepare the state, you definitely get this outcome. But it doesn't rule out that there might be some more stuff going on, okay? So you know, in order to certainly get this outcome when I prepare this state, it has to project onto the support of that. And then just in order for these to add up to the identity, it's going to have to be that it's orthogonal to the support of this guy, right? If it contains a projector onto this guy, it has to be orthogonal to this guy. But that doesn't mean there isn't some other part of the Hilbert space where it's not a projective measurement. Okay, so that's what this part gets you. And then there's a second part, which is a bit harder to get your head around, which is that there has to be a way of mixing together these states SI
a piece of I. This piece of I?
Or it's I? Piece of J. I don't know why.
No, it's okay. Sub-chop resolution.
Okay.
It was actually Sorry. Exists, and I was wondering.
Oh, hey, yeah, that's really bad.
It just looked like a row, but yeah, I see. And that's AJ or just A comma?
Wow. Not sure someone with handwriting my badge should really be doing a blackboard tip. Okay, so you need that there's some way of mixing together these states that make this outcome definite with Oops. With the state S, that basically is the state you're actually interested in, and some other state S prime. Okay, so you have to be able to, you know, this just operationally means that you choose amongst the SJs with various probabilities, and that has to be operationally indistinguishable from, with some probability, preparing the state you're interested in, and with some other probability, preparing some other state. And so this isn't really a definition of the measurement being projective in some kind of absolute sense. It's telling you it's projective as far as this state S is concerned. So again, it's useful to see what that means in quantum theory. And if you think about it, so this, let me just write this equation out again in quantum terms. So in quantum terms, when you mix your state preparations, you just take the corresponding convex combination of density operators. And the things being indistinguishable means it's the same density operator. And then for this equation to be true, it must be that the support of rho is inside the support of this guy, right? Because I'm just adding another positive operator to it. So I can't get rid of any of the support of this, and it has to be equal to this. So I hope I get this notation right.
Sorry, I didn't get the logic.
Uh-huh.
What is S? Is this true?
So this whole thing. Yeah, I should have been much clearer about that. This whole thing is like supposed to be a definition of this this measurement EJ being in some sense projective on a particular state. So you just plug in the state you care about here, and then you just see if you can pick probabilities and another state S prime that satisfies this. Okay, and the consequence of that is that the support of the state you're interested in is within this union of all the supports of the states that make the measurement outcome definite. And so if you look at this particular example, what that would mean is that the support of rho has to be in the subspace spanned by these two states, 0 and 1. Okay? So maybe you know, rho might be something like the projector onto plus, right, where plus is a superposition of 0 and 1. Okay, so it rules out rho having any support in this other part of the Hilbert space where the measurement isn't actually projective, because if it did, you would never be able to find a way of satisfying this equation. Okay, so that's the sort of way of getting... you know, it doesn't quite get us it being a projective measurement, but it gets us it being a projective measurement on the relevant subspace. And then maybe sort of not too surprisingly, the way that you weaken this to some kind of notion of epsilon close to being projective is you just is you basically just require that this probability is large when you prepare the corresponding state, and that it's small when you prepare a different state. Okay, and this is the sort of requirement that you might actually be able to meet in an experiment. Okay, and then once you have this sort of definition in mind, you just sort of go back to your principle, and you explore the consequences of having that kind of measurement under this kind of principle and with the other assumptions that go into the inequality, and you find indeed that there's some limit on how small epsilon can be before your experiment actually shows that you have contextuality.
So when you originally introduced this, you were going to say that you said going from the Kirchner Speckle to this epsilon close to projective was kind of a bit of a hazy idea, but this was going to be a better motivated.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just not quite understanding the distinction here, so maybe you could you spell that out a little bit more?
So I haven't actually motivated this definition.
Because I mean, to me it seems exactly like this.
Right. Yeah, it is. Okay. So, in the interest of time, I didn't want to explain
okay, sure.
this definition and then this definition. And so I was just kind of trying to give you an idea of the kind of definition of projectiveness that you end up with if you do this.
Okay, that's fine.
But yeah, maybe
we can
discuss the logic of where this comes from. Yeah.
I had a similar question. You showed those two arrows that ultimately arrived at this definition, but
mm-hmm.
where did the epsilon get in? Is there an epsilon in this Speckens definition of contextuality? So how did epsilon get into the definition of something that didn't have an epsilon?
That's a great question. So basically, this definition has consequences for all measurements. So it puts a restriction on how you represent any measurement in order to be able to call your model non-contextual. And then you can just kind of specialize the definition to different cases. So you can say, okay, if I have a definition that satisfies this notion of projectiveness, what's the consequence of this definition? And then you can say, well, if I have one that's epsilon close, what's the consequence of this definition? And you just see that this definition implies some kind of relationship between how close you are to being projective and how close you are basically to being deterministic. So because the definition itself is very general and can be applied to any measurement, you're able to sort of apply it to a spectrum of measurements that have different levels of being close to projective. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, it helps. I'm not sure I completely get it, but so the idea is that if you make this definition, then it implies that you satisfy the criterion almost or something.
Yeah, I'm starting to regret trying to explain this without actually explaining it. Do you have a better way of putting it, Rob?
I'm not sure it's confusion. Maybe it's worth saying that the Kirchner-Speckle definition only put a constraint on how you represent projective measurements and was essentially silent about how to represent any other measurement, like a POVM.
Right.
So what you essentially have to do is generalize it to make some statements about how you represent, say, any POVM. And then if you've done that, you can specialize it to the case of a POVM that happens to be close to projective.
Okay.
And see what the consequences are. So really you can
so do epsilon is some sort of measurement of how close to POVM is being projective.
Yeah, so if it happens, you go to the lab and you say, I've tried my hardest to make projective measurement, but I noticed that, you know, it's never perfectly predictable in any states, but it's 99% predictable. So, you know, I've got POVMs where epsilon is, you know, 0.01. What does a notion of non-contextuality say about how deterministic those should be in the underlying variable model? So if you have a notion of non-contextuality that applies to any POVM, you can just plug it in and it'll tell you how close you have to be to deterministic in the non-contextual model. So epsilon, you can think of as coming from your experimental apparatus, for example.
So is epsilon something like your POVM is a bunch of, I don't know what you call them, Krauss operators or something, these operators?
Effects,
yeah. Okay. Is epsilon basically a measure of how close that those are to being a single projection?
Well,
is it like the norm of the...
Maybe a simpler way of doing it, the way that Matt did, is that you don't need to worry about how to represent it necessarily, but you go looking among all sets of states and define epsilon as sort of the deviation from, you know, perfect predictability for some set of states in your measurement. So that's sort of an operationally meaningful way of defining epsilon. And I could ask my experimentalist friend, how predictable could you make those effects as you vary overall state preparations?
So, well, I just want to be sure I've understood. So, the aspiration which you succeeded did with in the case of contextuality was to give a watertight proof that quantum theory is, as we sort of theoretically believed, contextual. But,
well, it's the real motivation was to be able to do an experiment that shows that nature is contextual, whether or not
that's
quantum theory.
That's what I should have said. That's right. Nature is contextual. Yeah, that would be too strong an aspiration. This case,
I think
there is actually a path to an experiment that shows that there's nature does not have higher order interference.
I guess I was more thinking of the converse problem of how would you do an experiment that convincingly showed that it did have higher order interference?
It does.
Okay. Right, like how close do you have to get to these idealizations and these definitions? In order for your experiment to be a convincing demonstration of higher order interference. And in fact, you can ask the same question just about regular interference, right? We seem to, even for regular interference, we seem to only have definitions in this idealized case of these kind of perfect slits. But like what, you know, if you actually wanted to, maybe this is a bit, you know, a bit redundant at this point, but if you wanted to do like a really, really kind of formally convincing experiment to show that nature has interference, like what would be the requirements for doing that?
Yeah. So for a projective measurement, usually if you repeat it twice, it has to be the same.
Uh-huh.
Is it a content in this definition?
No. So it turns out that at least when you're worried about these proofs of contextuality that we were worried about, the way the measurement device behaves, like the way it leaves the system after you've done the measurement is just totally irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually, like, this has actually been kind of a surprise, maybe, because a lot of people that were kind of going down this route and trying to just define some notion, some kind of operational notion of being a projective measurement, thought that it would be very important that the measurement was repeatable. But it turns out that, you know, once you have this kind of general notion of contextuality in hand, you can see that you can do the whole argument without any reference to the state update rule.
So when you do it for interference, then you need something like, oh, here's projective measurement. Here's like projector 1 for slit 1.
Uh-huh.
Maybe according to this definition, it's projector 2 for slit 2. And then I need another projector, which is like P12, which is somehow the union of these two slits.
Mm-hmm.
According to what's written here, does that also tell you maybe an operational formulation of this union, where you say,
in order to check that P12 is somehow P1 plus P2, here is something I have to check operationally. Maybe something along the line that, which in the quantum case leads to the support being contained in the bigger support in the last line here.
So you potentially would end up, might want to end up with some kind of statement where if you, whenever you can satisfy this equation for S0 and S1, then S gives you very good predictability for the like S0, 1, right? So if you, sorry, gives you for E0, 1, right?
Yeah.
So you have your E0, E1, and you've checked this definition, and that's given you some set S0 and S1, and then you might end up wanting to check that for all S that this is satisfied, the kind of combined E0, 1 also gives you high predictability for that S.
Which is in fact an approximate version of one of the things that we discussed yesterday.
I'm actually interested to know whether in the perfect case this corresponds exactly to this notion of faces. It seems very closely related to these faces.
I was wondering whether, say, S prime is what, just any state?
Yeah.
Doesn't have to have any relationship to the SIs.
No.
Okay, so you're saying that this thing, S, is below some mixture of the SIs.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can pick any SIs you want that make this thing.
Mm-hmm.
That does sound to me like it's probably a phase, but yeah, you were clear.
When you said you'd like to specify even the definition of interference, did you just mean the non-satisfaction of the order 2 sum rule? Like, you know, make that a robust notion? It just occurred to me that maybe something like the trade-off that exists between which way information and fringe visibility seems to be a kind of operational way of characterizing interference phenomena. So as I dial up the noise, if there's a point when maybe I can have both which way information and fringe visibility with a certain amount of noise, but if I suffer a trade-off, then it's showing interference.
Yeah, that might be the sort of consequence you end up getting. But, you know, as I said, I'd really rather, like, have some principled way of, like, okay, here's the, like, principle that's at stake in an interference experiment, and now let's work out what the consequences are, instead of saying, like, well, here's, you know, some particular mathematical thing that I think is a signature of interference, and now let me just kind of declare that to be what I mean. Do you see what I mean? Like I want to kind of reduce the arbitrariness of,
right,
of what you count
the
as.
Principle, is a candidate for the principle, there exists a trade-off between how much you can know about which way information and how much you can know about relative phase information under these operational definitions of what which way information and relative phase information is.
If you can do all that without any hint of sort of arbitrary choices of how you're quantifying things or anything like that, then that could work. Yeah. I mean, I suspect that if all you're interested in is second order interference, it's going to be like extremely widespread. Like probably, I guess under the definitions we've heard, any non-simplicial state space has.
Well, it would have second order coherence.
In
that term, but then the question is, do you have the projective measurements I mean, maybe you can always find some two-path experiment where there's transformations that are close enough to projections that it's okay. It's not completely obvious. That's a good question.
Yeah.
So just
sort of, I think it's important to consider the case where you don't have perfect projections, or operationally you don't have a perfectly distinguishable set of states. And one reason for that comes from potentially from quantum gravity. But if you have perfectly, you know, if you have a perfectly distinguishable set of states, then you can send information reliably to the future. That implies that you have a strict notion of past and future. And if you have some sort of indefinite causal structure, then fundamentally that will break down. So I suspect that fundamentally you can't have a set of perfectly distinguishable states. So it seems we have to get away from that notion, even though it plays a deep role in lots of different areas of quantum foundations. So
general commentary. Cool. Yeah, I don't think my motivations were so deep, but I like that one.
I'm pretty sure that is the face generated by the S-line. But you're just saying S lies in the face generated.
Okay, that's good. I mean, yeah, that makes it quite hopeful that whatever this principle is, could lead you to something like this.
Yeah. If you're trying to be as, quote unquote, realistic as possible, uh-huh. then what about the assumption that you can prepare the same identical state in infinite number of times, or arbitrarily many times? And should there be some epsilon on that too? Or some whatever that, I mean, that's clearly not, lasers are not absolutely stable, as we know, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, these are things you might worry about. I guess I'm kind of being a bit restrictive in what I'm calling realistic, and I'm saying, I guess, at this point, I would be happy to sort of say a definition is realistic if you can apply it to an arbitrary generalized probabilistic theory. So these kinds of definitions... Pardon?
Oh, God.
So, like, these definitions that use these objects, like these projectors, that just don't exist in, like, if you took a GPT that had these objects and you just perturbed it slightly, they would disappear very quickly. So, if the definition is realistic in the sense that you can see whether or not it holds in any generalized probabilistic theory, then that would be an improvement on the current situation. And if you're worried about these kind of issues, then you need to kind of just make progress in this definition of generalized probabilistic theory, because this assumption that you can do the same preparation as many times as you want is completely fundamental to the whole framework.
Can you just relax the definition of preparation to be an unstable preparation? So the fact that your label is unstable means that, like, your preparation isn't pure. And so there is no measurement which on this preparation, because it tends to...
It can completely cope with preparing mixed states, but there are types of things that wouldn't purely be preparing a mixed state, right? Like if you have a laser power that's gradually drifting over the course of the day, then that's not that each time you prepare the state it randomly chooses a laser power. It's that, you know, depending on what time of day it is, you get a different laser power. So there are some kind of failures of exactly repeatable preparations that are unproblematic, but there are other ones that are more harder to get your head around.
Yeah, I think, let me just emphasize that point, that one of the advantages of the GPT framework is that variations in the step preparation that are due to just statistical fluctuations aren't considered, you know, a failure to reproduce the same state. You just say, you know, what is the state? The state is, you know, here's a list of instructions on what to do in the lab. You go and you do them. And if there's statistical fluctuations, then maybe in the quantum model it means, you know, it's lots of different pure states on different instances. But overall, there's still some mixed state that describes it. And as long as you can cope with mixed states and noisy effects, you have no problem.
Right, but a drift is different.
Yeah.
A drift is different.
Well, if you don't know how it's drifted,
you could just average and say it's another kind of noise.
And if you do, then you would, you know, be saying, yeah, my GPT has changed a little bit. if you actually know, it's 3 p.m., so frequency has a different, you know, centroid or variation.
I keep measuring the reference.
Your operation.
You can't hear it. It's not bad. And it's okay.
If the reference doesn't drift, I guess.
you kind of cancel each other, you factor it out somehow.
You arrange to.
Yeah,
you factor. GPT therapists are very good at stabilizing labels.
Okay, so I was there another question?
No, no. I think you told me at one point that limit on the numbers. Data points you could take was the drifting of the stability of the laser. Are you saying that's overcome now? In the three slit experiment?
Yeah. No, that one, of course, there is still a problem because there is the spatial fluctuation which is a problem.
Oh, spatial.
It's not so much the intensity, because the intensity fluctuation you can get rid of by averaging. But if it's fluctuating spatially, then of course there's a big problem because, of course, these interference experiments are not spatial. So we're trying to get rid of that now. The other version.
Maybe that could be done as a structure, as a statistical effect, and then it would fit into this more general type of preparation.
Okay, so I've run out of time, but let me just give like a one sentence advert for the other thing I was going to talk about. Me and Rob are both involved in another experiment that's not published yet. That takes, like, I think Howard kind of said that this generalized probabilistic theory framework is kind of aspirationally operational. But we actually did an experiment and fitted a generalized probabilistic theory to it. And so these kind of techniques are what's giving me confidence that if we can come up with a notion that applies to any generalized probabilistic theory, then in principle we'll be able to test it in an experiment. So talk to either of us about that if it sounds interesting. Okay, thanks.